come on in.
And now, back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
The kids love him.
And your host,
welcome to paradise,
Bill Frank.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Bill Frank Radio Show here on KVTA News Talk 1520. I'm your host, Bill Frank. I'm bringing fresh perspectives to Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is business and politics. As we get closer to the election, these two subjects dominate the conversation. Each of my guests will discuss either business or politics. My next guest is a 35-year veteran of the licensing industry and one of its true pioneers. Beginning with the television smash hits Dallas and Dynasty, he was among the first to license adult primetime shows and apply branding techniques to them. We'll discuss licensing American products and culture abroad as an engine of our economy. Danny Simon built the licensing divisions for Lorimar Productions, 20th Century Fox, and Carolco Pictures. Today, he owns and operates the Licensing Group Limited, one of the industry's premier licensing agencies. He's a founding member of the International Licensing Industry Merchandisers Association. In addition to his licensing expertise, Danny is also a film producer, serving as the executive producer for the film Mortal Kombat, which was the first successful translation of a video game into a feature film. Danny's the co-author of two definitive books on licensing. The classic Basics of Licensing is a concise reference book for anyone already involved in licensing or those interested in getting into the industry. Joining us from Southern California. Hi, Danny. How are you today?
Good morning.
Well, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being a guest. And what an interesting subject matter expert you are. So I just want to start by positioning this for the listeners if I can, because today only 6% of our workforce in the United States is involved in manufacturing. That's down from 60% in the 1950s. But of course, in that time, our economy has grown steadily due to the rise of what we'll call the creative economy that you're involved in. 20 million new jobs were added in the creative industry since the 1980s alone, and exporting American products and culture has become a big part of this new economy. Countries outside the U.S. really seem they can't get enough of our products. However, some countries, especially those in the Middle East, have been criticizing the U.S. for having too much influence on local cultures. So my question to you, Danny, is this. What's the responsibility of American companies if they want to grow their business, especially by licensing outside of the country?
Well, I think the responsibility of any manufacturer is to make sure what they're producing and exporting is quality product. And in this case, when you're talking about trademarked and copyrighted material, which is primarily what we deal in, you know, what you want is you want to produce merchandise that reflects the positive elements of our country and our society. I frankly don't think we need to apologize to anybody for the interest in our culture around the world and the endless amount of thirst there is for a lot of what we have produced, whether it's entertainment or merchandise that is representative of brand names or trademarks. No more so than France has to apologize for creating a number of designer labels that are popular around the world. I think that's our right as a peoples to produce what we want and try to market it where we can.
All right, but let me take this a step farther if I can, Danny. So in what ways do American brands need to be modified in order to be successful abroad? And here specifically, I'm thinking about a movie, because that's an area that you're familiar with, Captain America, the First Avenger. Now, outside of the United States, the Captain America was dropped, and it was just called the First Avenger because in some countries there were concerns of anti-American sentiment.
Well, I think you have to take into consideration, and particularly when you're talking about merchandising and marketing of entertainment products, the titles and sometimes the content. And there have been not only changes in titles, but certainly editing of content for various markets because it's too salacious or it's too violent, and a watered down or a different, slightly different version has been produced for other markets. There's nothing wrong in creating merchandise or, in this case, marketing a film in the best way you can to be popular to the widest market you can reach. And if calling it Captain America is a turnoff in some markets, for whatever the reason, then by all means, if there's another way to title it, why not? You have to be sensitive to this.
I agree. My guest is Danny Simon, author of the book Basics of Licensing. We're talking about licensing products and content abroad. I was interested, Danny, in reading your book that there's so many different types of licensed products that are out there. I mean, some of them come to mind easily, things like apparel with Ralph Lauren, accessories, Prada bags, food and beverages with Pepsi and so forth. Sporting goods is real obvious with Nike and Adidas and so forth. But I found it interesting that the big three exports for us in terms of licensing were apparel, toys and games, software and video. Now, perhaps it's my biased look at this, but I would have thought that music and video would have been among the top three. So, in fact, it's really not that high at all in the rankings of things that we export. What's the reason for that?
And music, particularly, is a very interesting phenomenon. Although there is a great deal of overlap of interest in music from other markets, it is one of the cultural things that tends to remain the least popular form of entertainment that is marketable in other cultures. So many cultures have their own style of music, their own kind of music, where we just can't seem to elbow our way in and grow a very large audience. And it's true. If you look at other cultural kinds of forms of music, so few of them manage to get their way into this market as popular. Now, they have pockets of interest, but in overall popularity, their music stars are not necessarily ones that we embrace, and vice versa.
So when you look at supergroups like ABBA coming from Europe to the United States, or even going way back, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, with the British invasion coming into our country, and then all of the merchandising and the licensing that they did, would you consider that the anomaly, or was that just the times?
Most of those are the exception. If you look at the vast number of popular bands in America that have had huge careers overseas, except in some of the Western markets, because culturally, music-wise, certainly Europe and Western Europe is much more akin to our market in terms of tastes. But if you go very far beyond that, into the Indian and to the Chinese and the Japanese markets, a lot of times you'll find that we have made very little inroads over, by and large.
All right, my guest is Danny Simon. So, Danny, licensing and merchandising isn't new. I mean, most of us are old enough to remember Daniel Boone or Howdy Doody products being merchandised to us as children. So give us a brief history.
You just gave away your age.
I sure did, and the age of much of my audience, too. But give us a brief history of licensing in the United States, because I think it's a fascinating history.
Well, we saw, certainly, as you mentioned, a very popular form of licensing to some extent in the 50s off television. We saw it early in the 30s, which is in 35 when Disney really started to merchandise Mickey Mouse. But the popularity of licensing as we know it today is really an advent of two films, particularly Jaws first and then certainly Star Wars second. Jaws sort of opened the doors into a group of or a substantial number of consumers being interested in all things shark. And that interest, based on the film and the success of it, drove a licensing program by Universal that produced a lot of, shark product. The Star Wars film, however, was really the door closer in terms of really starting a new trend when, in fact, you had a significant amount of interest for anything that was related to that first film, whether it was figures, T-shirts, sunglasses, your costumes, you name it. It was a desire from the public to own a piece of it, and certainly has continued.
Danny, I was going to ask you, though, the difference between Jaws and Star Wars, which I would consider institutional merchandising versus individual merchandising, which if you go back to the 20s and the 30s was much more up to the individual artist. And specifically here I'm thinking of Walt Disney, who you mentioned, but also somebody like Shirley Temple, who, when she first met Eleanor Roosevelt, gave her a Shirley Temple button and made Eleanor Roosevelt wear the Shirley Temple button. So when did we cross that precipice between the individual huckster promoting himself or herself and merchandising their stuff to the institutional merchandising?
Well, I think that's what these films in the 70s did. I think that the 70s was sort of the eye-opener, and Jaws and Star Wars being the two event films that sort of kicked that door open, moving more so from an interesting opportunity to a counted upon and actually effort to generate secondary income off of merchandising. I mean, prior to Jaws or Star Wars, most studios didn't have licensing divisions within their setup. They utilized third-party agents.
I see. My guest is Danny Simon, author of the book Basics of Licensing, and we've been talking around Walt Disney and his expertise in this area. Certainly, he was a great practitioner of licensing with Mickey Mouse all the way through to today with Brave and their latest movie that's out there. One of the more interesting licensing disputes, however, in recent history is also between the Walt Disney Company and the heirs of A.A. Milne over the rights to Winnie the Pooh. That's right. You knew exactly where I was going with that.
It's case has been bumping around for an awfully long time.
Well, years, decades, in fact. But now it's been resolved, and the rights now belong to Disney. So explain how this is a good example of how licensing disputes get resolved.
Well, I think that when we talk about the Pooh case, which was a question of does Disney own the underlying rights or not, and were they transferred legally to them, it gets very specific and very legal. But what I think it points out is that Disney had done such an excellent job in merchandising and marketing the product that it was hard for the heirs to make a case that it was they were disadvantaged by that relationship. It's a case which I don't know enough about to talk about intelligently, but intellectual property right is fraught with legal issues over ownership and who did what and who created what. What's interesting to note, if I can switch around for a second,
sure,
Go back to Disney, is that through Disney, not him per se, but a guy who worked for him named Kay Kamen, we really came up with the sort of deal format that is still worked today, which is royalties being generated by the sales of merchandise and then paid to the property owner by the third party who's licensing the merchandise. And when they started out, Kamen started merchandising Mickey Mouse back in the 30s, he didn't know what to charge for the right to use the character on an item. And what he did was liken Mickey to somewhat of a salesman and gave him a salesman's commission of 5%. So he asked the merchandiser, the licensee, to pay him a royalty of 5% on the product that he sold using Mickey Mouse, as he would pay any kind of a salesman who generated the sale.
Now, that's fascinating. My guest is Danny Simon, author of the book Basics of Licensing. And Danny, the 700-pound gorilla in the room that nobody has talked about yet in this conversation is rights and foreign countries, because there are a number of foreign countries, notably China, that regularly ignore copyright and trademark. What can U.S. companies do to protect its intellectual property going into these countries?
Well, they've got to be smart and understand that it's fraught with problems. If you have a popular trademark, chances are it's going to be pirated by somebody in some product form. It's sort of like a left-handed compliment, if you will. If you're not popular enough to be pirated, do you really have a popular property? But it is a problem, and one that is going to take a long time to cure. And the cure is, and we've seen it already, it's when the marketplace, whether it's China or any other market, has enough of its own material, its own intellectual, homegrown intellectual property content to care about and to police and to control, is when this problem starts going away. And we saw that with the Olympics. I mean, the government created a Olympic police, if you will, to go into the markets and to make sure that people weren't using the Olympic marks without authority. So they did have something worth protecting, and they went about it in trying to control it. And that, plus the fact that China wants to be an active member in the World Trade Organization, which demands that those countries participating in the World Trade Organization control and regulate trademarks and copyright, respect of that material. has been the other factor that is driving China more into a compliant position.
My guest is Danny Simon, author of the book Basics of Licensing, How to Extend Brand and Entertainment Properties for Profit. Danny, in writing the book, what did you want readers to take away from reading your book, Basics of Licensing?
Well, it's really written for people who have interest in the subject, who want to be practitioners in the project, process, and people who are looking to sharpen their skills. You know, we really try to give everybody a good overview of the industry, how it operates, and what are the essential elements of in trying to market and merchandise a property. We've done a follow-up book, which is being released this month, called Basics of Licensing, the Licensee Edition. So for what we've done for the licensor with the first book, we've now attempting to do for the licensee, meaning this person who is taking on the rights to build product. You know, how do you judge a property? How do you make a good deal? What are some tips and hints in making sure that you have a positive relationship rather than a negative one?
That is great. My guest has been Danny Simon, author of the book Basics of Licensing. Danny, you've probably piqued the interest of some of my listeners. If they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go?
I would suggest going to the Basics of Licensing, www.basicsoflicensing.com, where we have information on both myself and my co-author, Greg Battersby, who's a brilliant trademark attorney.
That is great. Thank you so much, Danny, for being my special guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you very, very much, Bill.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.